Thank you for tuning in for the March 29th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology Family of Journals. In this week's feature interview, Drs. Ariane Lewis and David Magnus discuss the need to update the Uniform Declaration of Dead Act, the UDDA, aligning the legal criteria with the medical standards used to determine death by neurological criteria.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Norton Neuroscience Institute in Louisville, Kentucky. And today I'm really pleased to welcome Ariane Lewis, who is the Director of Neurocritical Care at NYU Langone Health, as well as David Magnus, a bioethicist from Stanford University. And we invited them to join us today to talk about their paper that was published in this week's issue of the journal Neurology titled, Revise the Uniform Determination of Death Act to Align the Law with Practice Through Neurorespiratory Criteria. Ariane, David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
So this act, the Uniform Determination of Death Act, is sometimes referred to by UDDA. So what is this UDDA statute? I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know a lot about this. I've heard of it before, but why should we, you know, neurologists practicing in the community, why should we know about this death act? And then secondly, why is it important for us to even more broadly have a universally recognized definition for death?
The UDDA was written in 1981 by the President's Commission for the Study of Ethical Problems in Medicine and Biomedical and Behavioral Research, and it was written for the purpose to legally clarify what determination of death is in the United States. And what the UDDA states is an individual who has sustained either irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions or irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain stem, is dead. A determination of death must be made in accordance with accepted medical standards. The UDDA is relevant to neurologists, of course, on account of the fact that we declare death using neurologic criteria. We declare brain death. We have standards that were put forth in 2010 by the American Academy of Neurology on how to declare death by neurologic criteria. These were revisions of the 1995 standards put forth by the AAN. And the 2010 standards put forth by the AAN are the current accepted standards for determination of death by neurologic criteria in adults in the U.S.
In terms of why this is important, obviously the line between life and death, especially as a legal boundary, is incredibly important for a wide range of issues. It determines when somebody can remarry, when somebody's life insurance pays out. So it's really important to be very clear about where that line is drawn. In addition, and this has been part of the discussion and the development of the concept from the very beginning, it's important for both how to treat somebody who's expired. At what point is it appropriate for hospitals to say that it's time to stop and withdraw ventilatory support? And it's also important for organ procurement. And changes, or depending on how you define this, can have profound implication on thousands of people awaiting organs in the U.S. So for all of those reasons, this is very, very socially important, and it's important to have uniformity across the country as much as possible. You don't really want the situation to arise where who's dead in one state varies dramatically from who's dead in another state, and where you'd have such variation in practice and questions about whether somebody's still legally married, as well as differences in the ability to be able to procure organs across states.
Yeah, that makes sense. So in this paper, I mean, in the very title, you're calling for a revision to this statute, this criteria, the UDDA. And so what exactly are the limitations or some of the controversies surrounding the UDDA as it's currently written?
So there's a couple of different controversies, and actually, just, you know, for clarification for everyone, the UDDA is actually being revised now. So this paper isn't just simply a proposal to revise the UDDA, but there is actually a process underway. The Uniform Law Commission is working on revising the UDDA. So a study committee met last year to address the question as to whether the UDDA needed to be revised, and the decision was that there was indeed a need to revise the UDDA, and now a drafting committee will be meeting until 2023 to decide how the UDDA will be revised. And in terms of why the UDDA needs to be revised, there's a number of aspects of the UDDA that have raised questions and concerns. First is the question as to whether the phrase irreversible should be replaced with the term permanent. David, do you want to speak a little bit about the difference between irreversible and permanent?
Sure. When the UDDA was first developed, I think people were not as clear about thinking through those things. But what's become increasingly clear as people have refined our understanding of this language, irreversible means can't be reversed, as opposed to permanent, which means will not be reversed. So, for example, in the context in which a patient dies in the ICU, if a patient is full code, then they wind up being declared dead after some effort has been made to resuscitate them that has failed. So potentially 20 minutes, 40 minutes, 45 minutes after cessation of circulation. In contrast, if a patient is a no-code, say I have a DNR order, then when circulation ceases, then as soon as it becomes impossible for spontaneous circulation to restart, that's the point at which they would be declared dead. The current standard makes the standard irreversible, which would mean that you would have to wait a much longer time after circulation is stopped, even for those no-code patients. And that turns out to have profound implications for procurement of organs from something called donation after circulatory death. That would be problematic. And it doesn't fit at all with current practice in declaring death across the board, whereas permanent cessation would be more coherent with what we actually do.
And then there's a couple of other issues with the UDDA. One is whether consent is needed to determine death. So it's not common practice to obtain consent prior to declaration of death by neurologic criteria, but some have argued that consent should be obtained. Additionally, sometimes there are objections on the part of families to the use of neurologic criteria to declare death, and the UDDA doesn't provide any guidance about how to handle these objections. The UDDA also uses the phrase accepted medical standards, but this is a bit nebulous as to what should be considered the accepted medical standards. And then lastly, questions have been raised about whether absence of hypothalamic and pituitary axis function, such as the secretion of antidiuretic hormone, should be included or considered included in all functions of the entire brain. And if so, how we can reconcile the fact that that's not tested in the medical standards for determination of death by neurologic criteria published by AAN, or the pediatric standards that are published by the Society of Critical Care Medicine, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the Child Neurology Society.
Thanks. Yeah, let's unpack that last idea a little bit more. So my understanding when I read this paper was basically the argument that if someone does not have diabetes insipidus, then in theory, their hypothalamus and pituitary are still functioning. So how can we really say that they are brain dead if they do still have some brain function vis-a-vis the hypothalamus and the pituitary? Is that right? Is that the reason that we're talking about that? And also, could you just give us a brief refresher? I'm talking about diabetes insipidus, but could you give me a brush up on diabetes insipidus and what that really entails?
Yeah, sure. So the AAN standards and the pediatric standards require that for determination of death by neurologic criteria, a patient be comatose, have absence of brainstem reflexes, and be unable to breathe spontaneously. But these standards don't require anything related to testing of the pituitary and hypothalamic axis. So diabetes insipidus can occur when there's lack of secretion of vasopressin or antidiuretic hormone from the hypothalamus and the pituitary axis. And diabetes insipidus is a situation whereby there's too much fluid being secreted from the body because there's no antidiuretic hormone, which is causing the body to hold on to the fluid. So as a result, in the setting of diabetes insipidus, patients can urinate a lot and have a very high sodium. And so one question that's been raised is whether the presence of diabetes insipidus is necessary to declare death by neurologic criteria and should be considered part of all functions of the entire brain, despite the fact that the need for diabetes insipidus is not included in the current standards.
And so in this paper, you propose new criteria, which you call the neurorespiratory criteria. So David, could you give us a definition of that and how that's different than the criteria currently used in the UDDA? And can you also kind of, you know, make a case for why you think this criteria would be more helpful using this neurorespiratory criteria?
Yeah, it really speaks to some of the problems around hypothalamic functioning that Ariane was just talking about. One of the challenging things is when it comes to cardiac function, it's pretty clear when you look at the current UDDA that it's, you know, irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions. It doesn't say respiratory functions of the lung or the upper lung, or it doesn't specify parts. Whereas right now, the definition describes, when it comes to the neurological part of the definition, irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain. So it really specifies anatomy as well as function in that definition. And so we want to instead really just focus on the functions that matter to be very clear, because right now there's an, I would say at best an awkwardness, at worst a conflict between the fact that the determination of death is to be made in accordance with accepted medical standards, and those medical standards do not test for the functions of the entire brain. The hypothalamus has been the site of most of the debate that's been going on about whether or not there's consistency between the American Academy of Neurology standards and the actual statutory law. But there are other parts of the brain that are not evaluated either, that nobody's really wants to pay much attention to. And that highlights why it's probably a mistake to focus on the anatomy, and it'd be better to really focus on the functions of the brain that actually really matter and are what determines death. And that's really something that arises in the context of a brain injury leading to the loss of the capacity for consciousness, the ability to breathe spontaneously, and the loss of all brainstem reflexes. That's what the actual tests evaluate. Those are the things, if you go back and look historically at all the major discussions from all of the major professional societies and virtually everybody who's really been thinking about this issue deeply, about an approach that has worked for more than 40 years and is very well grounded in clinical practice. And so we think it would be a huge mistake to think that because of differences in interpretation of the law as written, that clinical practice would need to change because of the language in the drafting and because lawyers said this is what it should be. We think it'd be better for the law to be brought into coherence with actually well-established, successful clinical practice rather than the other way around. And so we think this concept, which has a tremendous amount of support from it, if you look at the historical documents from the developments from virtually every group that's really been thinking about this concept, it corresponds with practice and avoids the potential that judges looking at this law may say current practice fails to meet the legal standards for brain death.
So I guess last question here, Ariane, you mentioned earlier that this is currently being revised, this criteria. And I think you said that we'll know more next year. So we're recording this in March of 2022, but we should have something more definitive in 2023. Is that right? Is there any other updates we should be looking for between now and then?
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of the revision, as you said, that this would be finalized, whatever the revision is going to be, in the summer of 2023 by the Uniform Law Commission. So it's important to recognize that though the proposal that David just discussed is one proposal that's on the table, that is not clearly definitively what the revised UDDA is going to say, and the different areas of concern related to the UDDA that I mentioned are not definitively going to be addressed by the revised UDDA. Additionally, it's important to recognize that the UDDA is a federally recommended statute. This is not a federal law. So this means that once the Uniform Law Commission decides how to revise the UDDA, every state has the opportunity to decide whether they're going to accept the revised UDDA as their definition of death, number one. And number two, they have the opportunity to be able to make amendments or revisions to the revised UDDA themselves. So the present situation in the U.S. is that although every state throughout the country accepts death by neurologic criteria as death, there are some subtle differences in the language. So not every state uses the exact language of the UDDA. And then in addition, there's some variability in different aspects of the legal considerations related to determination of death by neurologic criteria, such that, for example, in four states, there's specific language in the law related to how to manage religious objections to the use of neurologic criteria to declare death. So it'll be interesting to see how all this plays out.
Can I just add that I think the stakes here are pretty high? For example, if the decision was made to require testing for diabetes insipidus because of desire to adhere to this notion of the whole functions of the whole entire brain and all of its functions, if that really were to be maintained, it's difficult to know exactly how many organs a year would be lost that are currently procured from brain dead patients. But I think a ballpark estimate based on some work that people have done about how many patients who are currently declared brain dead actually have some hypothalamic functioning, as well as recognizing that those are often the more hemodynamically stable patients, we could lose as many as half of the organs that we are currently using from cadaveric sources for transplant, which could potentially mean the death of as many as 20,000 people a year. So the stakes for how this is defined are actually quite high.
In terms of the existing data on the frequency of diabetes insipidus in patients who are declared dead by neurologic criteria, it can range from 9 to 90% across series. So obviously, there's a wide range of variability as to whether or not patients who meet the conditions set forth in the standards produced by the AAN and the pediatric standards actually do indeed develop diabetes insipidus. Of course, if the need for diabetes insipidus was required by law, this would now need to change the AAN standards and would, of course, require a change in the process by which we're declaring death by neurologic criteria and subsequently change who has been declared dead by neurologic criteria.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I appreciate you pointing out the nuances here of the UDDA and the revisions that you all are proposing. And talking about the hypothalamus and the pituitary function and how these things, although admittedly I don't think about them a whole lot, really make a difference when we're trying to be precise about our definition of death. So thank you both for joining us and for going over these subtle differences regarding the definition of death and these different criteria. To our audience, I encourage you to check out the paper. Again, it was published in this week's issue of the journal Neurology. The title is Revise the Uniform Determination of Death Act to Align the Law with Practice Through Neurorespiratory Criteria. Once again, I've been speaking with Ariane Lewis from NYU Langone, as well as David Magnus from Stanford. Ariane, David, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Jose Merino. Be sure to check out this week's journal, which includes an article investigating the association of loneliness with dementia risk, as well as a study looking at cortical proteins associated with cognitive resilience in older adults. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.